Welcome, everyone, to the Percepta Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer, and we got a great podcast for you tonight. This is part two of my talk with Red Hook Games about their latest title, The Darkest Dungeon. And joining me tonight, co-founder Tyler Sigmund and returning guest, creative director and artist, Chris Barassa.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, Chris, it's great to talk to you again, and Tyler, it's great meeting you tonight. I know we were planning on talking last time, but we kind of ran into a little hiccup.
It's good to get on and spread a little news about the game.
Awesome. So, I figure before we continue our discussion about gameplay, I just wanted to talk to you guys about catching up with what's been going on with Red Hook and the Darkest Dungeon since we last spoke.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we've been hard at work. I mean, we talked a long time ago, actually.
Yeah.
It feels like a long time ago to me.
Yeah, like, what was it, like 3-4 months? I mean, this whole year has just been, like, moving, like, at mock speeds for me. So I don't know how it must be going for you guys.
There's never enough time on the schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we have no shortage of excitement and activity and things to do. So, you know, it's a mix of pure fun and constant stress. Pretty much
sure.
Like the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Pure horror.
Yeah, definitely. So, before we get to talking more about game design, Tyler, since you are the co-founder for Red Hook, I wanted to get your thoughts on a question that I talked to Chris about last time. When we spoke, we talked about the Kickstarter and the formation of Red Hook, and he basically talked about how the studio was founded pretty much to make The Darkest Dungeon. So I just want to get your thoughts on, essentially, what led you to basically founding the studio and coming up with the idea for the game?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because people kind of found studios for different reasons, I think. And in this case, you know, Chris and I just had a real desire to work together again.
Mm-hmm.
We've worked together in the past and at game studios, and then we were friends and, you know, have a real good appreciation of each other's talents outside just the friendship. And, you know, we've been looking for opportunities to do something together and batting around ideas, but we've also been pretty busy, you know, at different companies and doing other games and things like that, and kind of dabbled in a few projects. And finally, a window opened up that, you know, we realized would be a good chance for us to do something together before we got kind of absorbed into other companies again.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, we had talked a lot about game ideas that we wanted to do just over the course of a couple of years, really. And Darkest Dungeon was originally something that Chris came up with as kind of putting a specific spin on, you know, a dungeon crawling RPG.
Mm-hmm.
And both really liked the idea a lot, and it seemed to bear a lot of fruit in discussions. You know, every time we'd talk about it, it was really easy to talk about more and more things that we'd like to do within it. So kind of when that window opened up, you know, we both knew that that was the project that we wanted to do. Like, if we could only pick one thing to do, that was the one we wanted to hit first.
Cool. I know last time we spoke at length about the work that went into your guys' very successful Kickstarter, and I just want to get, like, your thoughts, like, how did the Kickstarter work for you, or what were your impressions of doing the whole crowdfunding campaign?
Yeah, sure. It's still ongoing. So, you know, you know, in terms of, you know, that's one thing about Kickstarter that's
never stops.
Yeah.
No, it never stops. You know, your funding window stops, but, you know, then you've got a relationship with, you know, and in our case, about 10,000 people that have, you know, seen fit to help make this game a reality. And, you know, so that's an ongoing obligation that you have that we take really seriously. But it's really interesting. I mean, it's cool times. I mean, first of all, yeah, I love Kickstarter. I think it's awesome. I think a lot of great games have come out of it. You know, I think for every kind of dodgy project that people think, maybe that wasn't a good idea, there's at least one or more awesome ones that, you know, people have directly contributed to helping get made. And I think it's a great business model, especially in this kind of day and age when on the business side, and this isn't something fans really need to be concerned about, but on the business side, you know, there's a lot of disruption in terms of the publishing model and funding models and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And crowdsourcing is awesome because it really does put the power in people's hands to say, I want that. And things that wouldn't get made, you know, if not for people's support. So it's a great way to go right to people instead of having kind of a middleman that, you know, tries to determine what people are going to like. You just let the people determine what they're going to like.
Yeah.
So for us, you know, we took it really seriously. We put a lot of effort into it. And fortunately, you know, it went well, I guess, according to strategy. But you never know. All you can really do is have a game plan and hope the game goes according to plan.
Definitely. And I know that I told Chris last time on the cast, so I just wanted to tell you as well that definitely congratulations on the Kickstarter. I think you guys did an amazing job pitching it. I think it is one of the best examples of a Kickstarter project for 2014.
Oh, thanks.
Not a problem. So with that, we're going to continue our discussion on game design. And for those of you listening to this cast, we spend part one basically talking more about the formation of Red Hook Games, the Kickstarter campaign, and slightly getting into game design for that post. And if you missed listening to that cast, there will be a link to that in the podcast notes below. Let's talk more about game design. Chances are a few of my questions may be repeats from the previous cast, because it has been, I think, 3-4 months since we last spoke, but we'll definitely get into some new territory tonight. So I guess the first question then for both of you is, for people who aren't aware of The Darkest Dungeon, or those who haven't been paying too much attention, what is the general process or the general game flow of the game like?
You want me to take that one, or you got it?
I don't know, sure. It's like you're talking about just the sort of game loop, I guess, what you're going to be spending your time doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, essentially, think of it as like XCOM meets Dark Souls. Mm-hmm. So you recruit and manage a roster of heroes. There's a town metagame, a little bit of base building, where you sort of upgrade this ruined hamlet, improving the facilities and gaining access to higher tiers of skills and weapons and armor. You recruit essentially mercenaries. There's 16 playable classes, and you pair them up into groups of four and send them out on dungeon runs of varying length and difficulty. And the central hook of the game is essentially that everything that happens causes or alleviates stress in the dungeon, and that's a persistent factor. So when they get back to town, they might have a little bit of PTSD or trauma that you need to sort of cope with. And essentially, as you progress through the dungeons, you increase your mastery over different regions and toughen your guys' mental resolve up enough that they can take a run at the Darkest Dungeon, which won't actually come until the game ships.
Okay, cool. Now, one question I had from last time that I definitely want to mention here is regarding the class balance or the design. On the previous cast and watching videos of the game being played, one of the interesting elements behind the classes themselves is how each class basically has skills or abilities related to three distinct groups of play. You have how they react in combat, how they explore the dungeon, and how they respond or what they can do during the camp segments. And as you just mentioned, regarding recovering and dealing with the stress of the dungeon. So my next question for both of you is, what was like the general philosophy with how you were designing the various classes of the game?
Sure.
For Tyler, yeah.
Hey, yeah. Well, I mean, the fun thing is, you know, we're still designing them. So, but we definitely have had a philosophy, which is, it's to some degree theme first. You know, we think of an interesting class and we really start trying to explore what that class would do and what, you know, what makes sense thematically for the class, and then translate that theme into mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the fun parts about, I guess, Darkest Dungeon is that we don't feel the absolute need to balance all the classes exactly equally. I mean, obviously they're going to be, you know, in their same order of magnitude type balance, but it's not an MMO. It's not a, you know, it's not something like that where the class versus class type, you know, interactions have to be absolutely a certain way. I mean, we want you to try to solve different problems in the dungeons with different groups of people, because unlike maybe like, you know, essentially you're building a group of four, but unlike a traditional RPG where you do that and then you spend 80 hours with that group of four or 40 hours or whatever it is, you're taking a different group of four down each time you do a dungeon, which is anywhere from, you know, 15, 30, 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want you to experiment with different combinations. And like you mentioned, it's a real on-point observation about, you know, there's combat, there's exploration, there's camping, and there's also town, actually.
Okay.
Some classes, you know, behave differently in town. Like they have different stress healing restrictions as far as what activities that they can do. The bounty hunter gets the most benefit out of gambling. The Vestal gets the most benefit out of praying, you know, these sorts of things. And so I don't know, you know, I guess in keeping with a lot of the game that, you know, we're trying to keep the theme very strong,
mm-hmm.
and not find ourselves doing silly things just to keep absolute balance that don't really make any sense. We're trying to say things like, okay, you know, the Jester is a really strong party support character, maybe not as strong in combat, you know, straight up as the Hellion,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, his ability to impact the other characters is strong. Whereas Take the Leper, you know, is totally different. He's very solitary. His camping skills are quite weak in terms of what they do for other people, but he's really a self-support type guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really fun to kind of explore those things. And then, you know, we'll let, you know, we'll make sure nothing's completely broken, but we're not really starting at it from trying to make sure that all, you know, all mountains are exactly the same height, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point about class development. I know when I spoke with Chris last time, I brought up one of my favorite recent RPGs, the Etrian Odyssey series, that had a similar model of you had a party of five, and then you had these wildly different classes, but the skills were spread out far enough that there really wasn't, you know, that one class you must have in it. And that sort of goes back to sort of against the old school CRPG, you know, the holy trifecta of warrior, mage, cleric, and how you pretty much had to develop those three classes or your party was screwed. And that's one of the things I liked about Etrian Odyssey, and that's one of the things I'm really interested to see what happens with the Darkest Dungeon, with how you say how the classes themselves are very much different in these four disciplines. And that goes into not only how you play the game, but how your party dynamics will develop.
Yeah, you're going to have to realistically, you know, choose, like when you're assembling a party, you'll probably want to bring one of the healing characters, you know, you'll probably want to bring a front rank, strong combat character, but there's nothing absolutely restricting you. And we'd kind of like to see people come up with creative party groupings but moreover, I guess, you know, we're planning on having about 16 classes in the game. That's before any expansions. And so even if you say you knew you're going to bring a healer type, there's going to be probably four different types that you could pick from for your back row and, you know, stuff like that. So there's going to be a lot of variety and a lot of interesting ways to kind of combine. And some of the classes, I mean, some of them, I guess you could say, are, you know, definitely resemble archetypes, but we're trying also not to come at it going, okay, we need a, you know, we need an archetype of exactly this. We're just kind of saying, what are interesting classes? And, you know, how do we, of course, we want to make sure we don't accidentally make 16 warrior oriented classes only, you know.
Turn-based combat is interesting in that really it can be boiled down to like each encounter is almost a problem to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something that we try to really pay out is that there's multiple solutions to solving the combat problems that you're going to face in our game.
Yep.
Like even Tyler and I have pretty different philosophies and strategies about how we actually play the game.
Mm-hmm.
I favor like a lot of just balls out damage and it's risky and I demoed using it and just totally got my ass kicked. But I think as long as all the different classes are designed in such a way that although they may not be perfectly balanced, they're perfectly complementary.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can kind of realign them and try different combinations and solve those combat problems, you know, in different and kind of interesting ways.
Cool. Now, another point about the classes and in terms of progression that I wanted to touch on is with how the characters get stronger in the game. I know in videos, I believe last time we spoke, there's basically two ways for a character to become stronger. You can level them up through experience, they unlock new skills, or you buy them bigger and better equipment that makes them more powerful. And as we talked about, these characters, they basically keep all the horrors that they have in the dungeon, and if someone dies, they're pretty much gone for good on, you know, with very rare exception. In terms of balance, what is the difference between a character who has low levels, but you're giving them the best gear, versus someone who has crappy gear, but is very high level?
Well, before Tyler totally gets in on that, I should say that, like, we separate your skill power as well from your experience. So for us, resolve is the sort of experience quotient, and that only reflects like how seasoned or how veteran they are.
Okay.
You can upgrade, you can train a guy with the best skills or whatever, but he might be a really low level resolve.
Okay.
Yeah, it's so the primary way that, you know, experience is the one thing you can't buy, you know. And so we reflect that in the game with, you know, you go on missions and you become more of a veteran and that makes you stress resistant. And stress is a huge part of the game. And so if you take a very well-equipped hero who actually has no actual experience, and take them into a tough level dungeon, they're going to just be flipping out all over the place and get afflicted really quickly and then, you know, be at quite reduced effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. It's aliens, right? For fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah. So we, you know, so really to make a character very valuable, you need to send them on missions, have them survive because we do have permadeath, as you've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And, and then use invest money in purchasing better skills, better weapons and armor. Mm-hmm. And together that makes a powerful character. But if you do too much of one without the other, you know, if you invest heavily in their skills, but without really giving them a chance to level up, then that could be risky. And if you just level them up and don't advance their skills, that's not going to make them effective either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of a balancing act.
Now, in terms of the actual equipment themselves, is the progression of gear based on, like, strictly money, as in everything is unlocked from the start and it's just having enough money to buy it? Or does new gear become, like, available to purchase as you beat the dungeons and get further into the game?
Well, all your gear purchasing is done through the blacksmith.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you've got... It's tough to say, to characterize it as everything's unlocked until you buy it, because there's no way you'll have enough money to do that, so it's effectively locked. But we gate it with your cash. And okay. Also, you're going out in these dungeon runs to secure... family heirlooms, which are basically the currency you use to upgrade town. Okay. Different dungeon environments give different types of this heirloom currency in varying amounts. So
mm-hmm.
that's, in a sense, going to be a factor in terms of what mission you pick and where it is.
Cool. Is the gear in the game going to be randomly generated, as in you can find, you know, a rare sword or rare axe, or is all the gear basically hard-coded?
Well, we don't have, like, loot. You know, we're not a loot-driven game mm-hmm. in that complete sense.
Okay.
What we do have, though, are, like, there's a series of, you know, a bunch of trinkets, essentially, and that kind of speaks to the theme as well. Like, our focus is on the psychology
mm-hmm.
and the emotional toll of being an adventurer, not really on the sort of glorification of
okay.
armor acquisition. So you can find trinkets and kind of weird little artifacts and things like that you can equip in the traditional sense, and that'll actually give a little interesting kind of cost benefit to your characters. But we're thinking of it more like, you know, Hellboy has kind of like that satchel around his belt, and he's
mm-hmm.
got, you know, little charms and tokens that he's collected throughout his travels.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of our take on kind of the equipable stuff.
Okay. Now,
your weapons and armor progressions are locked to your character.
Mm-hmm.
They are like set progression options to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't find like a different sword and equip that. You've got a set sword progression for the Crusader, and you've got
mm-hmm.
set, you know, pistol and dirk progression for the Highwayman. But those trinkets that Chris mentioned allow you to customize a bit. And then the other thing that's really important is the quirks. So you have positive and negative quirks, which are basically, you know, the things that your personality quirks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you might eat twice as much, but, you know, you hate skeletons, or you're afraid of dark places, or, you know, you hit for more damage, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so as your character adventures, you acquire quirks. And that impacts your power as well. And
mm-hmm.
that celebrates, you know, the hero's personality, again, above the loot.
Okay. And the real, like, in terms of customization you have is more into, like, the characters and the skills you can unlock for them, right?
Yeah, and to some extent, the quirks they acquire,
mm-hmm.
you're going to get, you know, all sorts of different things, like Tyler mentioned. So you might have a highwayman that, you know, by virtue of surviving a dungeon or an experience that he had in a dungeon, gain like a eagle eye quirk, which gives him better crit chance or something
okay.
on his range attack. So he's now really valuable to you. In a future mission, he might develop tetanus or something, or something even worse. And you've got to kind of decide if you're going to spend money and treat that and kind of burn it off him, or if you're just going to kind of let it ride. So
mm-hmm.
the character customization is really an evolving process. It's not really limited, sort of like when and how you upgrade your stuff. It's really about what you tell them to do and what results from those instructions.
Now, one question I have before I forget is regarding what happens when the character basically hits that freakout point. I believe we either talked about this last time or was mentioned in the preview videos that when a character's stress reaches its boiling point, the character basically can either get a very good quirk or a very bad quirk. Or when that happens, are quirks basically... lock two different classes, or is it just like a pool of positive and negative quirks that can befall the character?
So yeah, that's we actually call those afflictions. So when
okay.
your stress reaches that boiling point, then you can become afflicted. And the difference between an affliction and a quirk is that
mm-hmm.
a quirk is a small personality thing that's persistent
okay.
and kind of always happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you're afraid of the dark, that's just kind of whereas an affliction is basically, you know, how when people get really stressed to their point, then they tend to act out. You know, some
yeah.
people act in anger, some people act in other ways. And so in this game, that's your afflictions. And those are things like paranoia, masochism, depression,
mm-hmm.
fear, selfishness. And so when you become afflicted, you're basically in a heightened state where you're going to act out under that affliction.
Okay.
And now you basically got to keep the party together and keep that character together while they're acting out in that state, and then go back to town and try to get the stress off of them, and then, you know, get them off their afflicted state. And so, yeah, and those are not linked to the classes. That's a personality thing.
Okay.
So, you know, you might have a masochistic cleric, or you might have a selfish cleric. I'm using cleric in the general sense. We have a vestal that's the closest to that archetype. But, and so that's neat, because when you recruit someone, you don't really know exactly what their, you know, what their, I guess, tendency is, until you observe them under stress. And then you'll see, like, okay, this one got paranoid. And every time that happens, there's kind of an increased chance that the next time that they get afflicted, they're going to react the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Because we find people are that way. People react to stress predictably for the most part, on a per person basis, I should say. And so, but it's not specific to your class.
Okay. Now, another point about the dungeons. I know we already talked about how the game features permadeath, and I was just wondering, when you're in the dungeons and if things are getting too crazy, is there like a, you know, a get out help button you can push to escape the dungeon without like costs, or, you know,
we should call it get out help button. I like that. Yeah, yeah, you can attempt to retreat when you're in the middle of a fight, and doesn't always work. When you're not in a fight, you can abandon the quest that you're on and flee from the dungeon. But kind of in true Darkest Dungeon style, we tax you a little bit, so there's a chance that they'll might develop like a cowardice quirk, and you also drop some of the loot that you're carrying, because it's basically like your guys just, you know,
get out of the hell, get out of
the hell. They've had enough. No one cares about your backpack when you're running for your life. Right?
Now, another part of the game that I definitely want to mention or discuss with you guys is regarding the enemy designs. Obviously, we talk about how the classes themselves not only have the physical tolls of the dungeon, but the mental ones as well. How does having those things to juggle affect how you're developing the enemies that the players are going to fight against?
I think I understand the question. Well, one thing is, because stress is a mechanic, we have some enemies that are physically damaging and threatening, and then some that are actually stressfully damaging and threatening. And that's, I think, one of the really kind of fun things about the game, and just honestly about combat, is we try to put you in some situations where you kind of have to trade off. So if someone's at their boiling point and about to become afflicted, you know, your priority might be to kill the stress damaging enemies first. So, like, for example, in the videos we've released and in the demos that we've shown at PAX, we've got like this little skeleton guy who was kind of a part. He was like a court partier beforehand and then became a skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got this cup of liquid that he splashes on you, and it doesn't do any damage. It's kind of creepy that
super
he's throwing
gross,
this
yeah.
mystery liquid on you.
Yeah.
And that's stressful. And he's a skeleton, for God's sake. That's stressful also.
And it begs the question, why does he even need to drink in
exactly,
the first place?
Yeah.
Which is the most horrifying thing of all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's something fun is, you know, we've got these, a whole new kind of thing opened of, you know, guys that are, you know, mess with your heads more than your body, so to speak. And then we, you know, we're working on a mechanic. I don't know if it'll be in there for early access, but that's kind of, you know, all about fears and hatreds of specific monster types, just because that's a great theme throughout, you know, I don't know. I mean, not just fantasy, but, you know, basically people's preoccupation with being extremely, you know, afraid of certain things or really hating certain things and being on a, you know, a vengeance quest against them. So that's something we can do with the enemies in terms of, you know, if you hate the swine folk of the Warrens, then, you know, you've got extra benefit to use that character down there for, you know, maybe they're doing extra damage and things like that.
Cool. Now, in terms of the classes themselves, I'm not sure if I asked this question to Chris last time, but are all the classes or a good amount of them unlocked from the start? Or do you unlock more as the game goes on?
We know we haven't really, there's no one philosophy. I think some are going to be maybe a little harder to get than others, but like we said, they're all sort of, no, there is no inherent class-based progression.
Okay.
You know, like a character that you might unlock a little later in the game isn't going to be like automatically just more powerful. We don't really think of it that way.
Okay.
But I don't think you're going to have access to everybody right away from day one.
Okay. Now, another part of the Darkest Dungeon that I found very interesting was the combat system. And going back to the videos you guys put out, there's, of course, this whole tackle element about where characters are in the lineup, what skills they have available, and how they match with the enemies who are also in their own party formation. In terms of developing the combat system, was this something that was pretty much set from day one, or did it take you guys some time and fine-tuning to come up with how the combat was going to play out?
You know, we it wasn't set from day one, no. I mean, we played around with different ideas in our heads, you know, everything from classic top-down Ultima style to, you know, I don't know, either Beholder style, you know, and we just tried out different ideas. And I don't know, yeah, we had some, we worked through a number of different kind of interesting ideas, but when we developed this one, it just, it really made sense that it was something new. It was a way to present the characters. I mean, Chris can speak more towards that, but, you know, had a nice visual benefit on top of the gameplay. And then once we kind of cracked the nut of realizing that the gameplay could work like that, and would be kind of like a familiar in terms of the types of mechanics you're dealing with, but definitely something new in terms of the side-on rank presentation. I don't think there's too many other games that have done exactly what we're doing. And so that kind of met our criteria, I think, for adding something new to the genre, but still building off of something that, you know, people knew how to do.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing too, is that, doing the combat and actually the whole game, from the side helps us play with the gameplay implications of being in really claustrophobic kind of awful places. So they don't have the freedom to kind of shuffle around, and party order becomes really important, and that's, you know, equally valid to the theme as well, you know, as the game design. So it's nice that they're connected that way. And okay. Also, it's easier to care about a character you can see. It's hard to really empathize with the top of someone's head. And so since our game is really about trying to, you know, build an attachment between the characters and the player, we wanted to give them as much opportunity to become fond of the characters as possible.
Cool. Now, one thing that I wanted to go back to that we talked about a few minutes ago is more about the game progression. I know you guys mentioned how one of the resources you have is sort of the family heirloom system and how you can basically improve the town. Is this currency or this resource, is that something that's unlocked every time you beat a dungeon? Is it based around quests or something completely different?
You gather it. You know, it is the resource that you gather through your adventuring. So just like gold, you know, you kill monsters and find stuff and open chests and search around the dungeon. You can also find the heirlooms. And the idea is that when your ancestor kind of pulled out the cork and let all these, you know, these guys run rampant over the land, then, you know, they've sacked the place and brigands have come and, you know, really all the great things that were in the town and your kind of ancestral home are now just scattered all over your lands. And so you can find them anywhere, and some areas, you know, have more of certain types. So that gives you an incentive. Let's say an upgrade you really wanted was requiring portraits. Then you look for the dungeon area that has portraits, and you can check the quest rewards. So you'll click on a quest and you'll see what that specific quest is rewarding, and that'll kind of guide your hand sometimes. So yeah, all that ties in, and it's gathered, you know, in all the various ways that loot is gathered.
Okay.
It's also important thematically too, because the whole idea of the game is that you've inherited this like tract of land and you're trying to right the sins of your father. So going out and recovering heirlooms, you know, on a metaphorical level kind of speaks to really what your whole quest is about, like restoring your family name and that kind of thing.
Cool.
Yeah. And they take up space in your inventory. You have a limited inventory, physically. That you can only fit so many items on when you're going through the dungeon, I should say. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you're going to have more treasure than you can carry, and heirlooms tend to be bulky and they have different stacking. So like gold stacks really well, but you know, portraits don't. So sometimes we want to give you that tension of, man, I really need portraits. Okay. I guess I'm going to throw out, you know, some of this other stuff and carry as many portraits as I can back.
Okay. Is your inventory based on like the party themselves, or is it a set limit throughout the entire game?
It's pretty much standard, regardless of who you're bringing.
Okay.
We have experimented a little bit with the idea that some classes might increase your inventory, but it has some UI problems that, it just might not be worth it. So generally when you go down, you've got a certain amount of room for the dungeon, and then you come back. And once you're back in town, it's unlimited generally. Like the currencies get cashed into your bank and the heirlooms just go into your kind of storing. And, so it's really just a dungeon specific thing.
Okay. Now, in terms of like going into the dungeon themselves, I know we talked about the different environments and there's quests involved. Are the quests based, like, do you have like a set number of quests in the game, or are they randomly generated?
Well, the quests are kind of interesting. We treat them a little bit like loot themselves. So mm-hmm. every time you sort of check your estate overview, mm-hmm. You can kind of see where the trouble's brewing. And we have a couple of several different kinds of quests. And like I said, there's a length and a difficulty component. So even a veteran player might be looking for a short, easy mission because he's taking rookies or, might not have that long to play. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, when you're ready to settle in and really get some great rewards, like the longer missions are there waiting for you. But you're never quite sure which dungeon environment is going to spawn what kind of quests when. So mm-hmm. every time you go there, it's kind of like a fresh experience, and you're kind of might be hoping for certain types of heirlooms to be available. Mm-hmm. You might be really looking to try out a new trinket that you got that helps mitigate poison. So you're hoping for something to open up, in the forest. So it's kind of an interesting twist on that, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, and there's different, not just the length of difficulty, but different goals. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're exploring, sometimes you're after something specific, other times you're killing a boss. Mm-hmm. So we've got different types that we're going to roll out. And then that's kind of something, we plan to expand also just because it's kind of fun to come up with those. And, later down the line, we can release even more types. And, that kind of opens up a lot of possibilities. I would say, it's not Baldur's Gate in the sense, like, you're going through a very set linear progression quest. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of procedural elements to what we're doing, and that's definitely intentional by design. I mean, we're inspired by roguelikes as well. And so we're kind of, there's a framework of key story quests around which all the procedural stuff happens.
I know one of the stretch goals was to add more procedural generated in the terms of like the bandit leaders or having these other bandit mm-hmm. groups that can appear and basically cause trouble for you besides the monsters in the dungeon.
Yeah,
that's been fun. We've done that. We've already created them, and that's essentially there's these other brigands cruising around, and you run into them sometimes, and so they're a little bit of an unknown in the sense of. You might be going to one specific dungeon and those enemies pretty well and you're expecting certain types of challenges. And then, you get assaulted by brigands who can always, they're always there.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question I have, in terms of going into the dungeons, and we just talked about the questing system, can you enter a dungeon without taking a quest, like just like a free play or a free explore? Or is all progression based around you choose a quest and then that sort of gives you the environment or chooses the environment for you?
You require a quest.
Yeah. You're not going to go into these places
without good reason.
You want to be sure that what you're doing makes strategic sense. I'm kind of joking, but I'm kind of not because of mm-hmm. the permadeath thing. Like, you probably don't just want to take a stroll and you really jeopardize or lose one of your guys just by virtue of a series of unfortunate twists and turns. So yeah, you need a quest.
Okay. In terms of the dungeon design itself, are all the dungeons based around like one essentially floor, or when you reach like the exit, you could go down to like another floor of the dungeon or escape or something like that?
It's a little bit more like you cloverleaf out from town and come back again, and sort of every time you go to a dungeon, it's like a new area of that environment. Mm-hmm. You're not actually being necessarily ever deeper. We think of it more like you go to a certain part of that dungeon and have an experience there, and then you might find different types of things in different runs of a single environment, mm-hmm. but it's not a continuous set, basically.
All right, I think with that, I just have one more general gameplay question, then we'll begin to wrap things up. And that has to do with the boss fights themselves. Are the bosses in the game going to be like linear, like hard code design, or will it be sort of like the brigands, like they could have like random effects or random abilities when you fight them each time?
The bosses are definitely created, they're hand designed. Mm-hmm. So, and then they're themed to their region. So the types of bosses like you'll face in the ruins are different from in the weald or the wood. And that's, we definitely want to hand create those. We don't want it to be a random smorgasbord of stuff. There's a place for procedural stuff and there's a place mm-hmm. for not.
Yeah.
And this is an area we want to give you a specific challenge. So, if people look at videos that are available, they may see the necromancer and he's like a summoner. So you're kind of like, he's summoning buddy skeletons and you're trying to either mow through those and get to him as fast as possible or neutralize him before he can summon too many of them. So that's an example of, kind of a simple boss mechanic. And so we've been having a lot of fun, like kind of working those out. Mm-hmm. And, And yeah, so you'll kind of know, like you'll get to know the bosses you'll face in each region eventually, and that'll impact your party creation and stuff like that.
Awesome. And in terms of the actual, like, overall game itself, have you guys nailed down, like, a length of how long you want the game to be, or is it still pretty much up in the air at the moment?
It's up in the air in terms of exact, but, I mean, I think it's safe to say we want to provide a lot of gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want the game to be completable in, you know, under I don't know, probably under 30 hours.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, that number is just pulled out, but the point is that... it's not, you know, there's going to be a lot of replay in there, but we also want to make sure it takes a good amount of time to kind of complete the whole, you know, the main story once. And then, of course, we kind of, it's a game, I don't know, Chris says it well, but it's a game to be played, not won. And that sounds silly, but it really is. Like, we're putting a lot of time into these systems. We want to experience different things. And even if you play through and win and see the whole story once, we want you to go back and do it again because you're thinking of different ways that, you know, of approaching it, and you'll have a different roster by nature of different things happening to you and things like that.
Awesome. So I think with that, we're going to start to wrap things up. I know it's late for me, it's late for you guys, and I definitely don't want to keep you. I want you to get back to work and get this game out as soon as possible.
Thanks.
So I just have a few just basic logistics questions for you guys, and then we will say our goodbyes. So I guess the first one, I'm sure a lot of people are interested in, is when are you looking to get the Darkest Dungeon on Early Access?
Well, Early Access is coming. Somewhere we've sort of updated in our backer update most recently.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-Feb is kind of where we're at right now.
Okay. And in terms of pricing, have you guys figured on a price for the game when we'll be on Early Access and when it's actually released?
Well, we haven't quite come out with anything yet. I think we're still holding on to that, and we'll sort of release a little bit more information about it as we get closer.
Okay. And I guess the last question for me is, in terms of like the actual like release time, release period, what are you guys like hoping to get the game released and finished by?
Oh yeah. We'll spend at least a few months in Early Access. We don't really plan, you know, there's some games that are really made to have a really, really long Early Access because it's not really, you know, Kerbal Space Program, they never really need to say it's done because there's just so many things they could add to the time. And it's not a game that you really require it to be done. It's an experimental game.
Mm-hmm.
But in our case, you know, there are some things we're going to hold out until full release, like the Darkest Dungeon and the remainder, the full story. So we want to use Early Access as just a great way to, you know, to give, you know, our most ardent fans a chance to be part of the development. And provide feedback and get to experience things, see how it's doing, and then use that time to put in, you know, the finishing touches. So, you know, I think expecting it to be in Early Access, you know, somewhere around 4 to 6 months is kind of the current plan.
Cool. Yep. And I know I speak not only for myself, but the fans, and say that we're all definitely looking forward to seeing how the game turns out, both on Early Access.
That was my wife.
Yep, everyone is looking forward to the game.
They're just looking forward to the game being done, and then we say, like, that's the most important criteria.
DLC, sweetie. Can I buy you dinner?
Yeah, plot twist, it's never done. No,
yeah.
Make sure to tell her all that during the dinner.
For the whole presentation, like, this is very much a living title, and I'll be really anxious about it.
Good news, it's done. Bad news, we're starting a sequel.
Yeah. And this time, we're really going to go crazy.
Yeah.
Definitely looking forward to that. Maybe your family not so much, but we are definitely looking forward to that.
Good. Well, we love nothing more than there really are so many ideas of things we want to do. And sometimes, you know, we have to make hard cuts. And we would like nothing more than to support it with a lot of content and expansion. So.
Awesome. Can't wait to see that. So I think with that said, that's a good place to wrap things up. I know for those of you listening, this is another Shorn cast, but these guys are definitely busy. And like I said, I don't want to be the reason why the game gets delayed. I don't want that hanging over my head anytime soon.
I already tweeted it.
Damn it. All right. And Chris, Tyler, it was definitely great having you on. I think we could have definitely talked, who knows, or maybe 2-3 more hours, but it's getting late. work has to be done, and you got to keep the family happy, of course.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.
Yeah, thanks again for having us, man.
Yeah, no problem, and definitely keep in touch, and hopefully we can talk again when the game's in early access, and definitely after the game is done and you guys have earned a very long break.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can send us hate mail because you lost your favorite character or something.
I'll be looking forward to that. All right. With that said, we will be wrapping things up for the cast now. As always, for those of you listening, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, there are several ways of doing so. If you'd like to be a future guest on the cast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find that information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And to contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure monthly funding for the site, you can find all that information under the Patreon banner on the front as well. So again, Chris, Tyler, it was great talking to you guys tonight, and I definitely wish you the best of luck with the Darkest Dungeon.
Thanks again, Josh.
Thank you, everyone.
Not a problem. So with that said, thank you for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.